I think it's good that we start off with a review of what we learned at the feast, to see what we were taught, to see where God was leading us. Covering so much material is difficult, so I might have to just refer to some scriptures, and you can check them up later, just for a matter of time, because we've got to cover something like 20 hours of sermons and sermonettes in the space of like 3 hours, wasn't it, he said, Mr. Bell? An hour and 10 minutes. So today we want to look at an overview of the whole feast, because there definitely was a theme. And the theme hasn't stopped, which I'll show you in a minute. There's one scripture you can turn to, and that's Matthew 24, verse 45. Matthew 24 and verse 45. Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his Lord has made ruler over his household to give them meat in due season? Or as the New Living Translation says, food at the proper time. And Christ said that, obviously. But you know what? He wasn't the first one to say it. Just make a note of this. Psalm 145, verse 15 says, the eyes of all wait upon you, and you give them their meat in due season. So King David said it 1,000 years before. But of course, obviously inspired by Christ. Back in the early 70s, the church was getting way off track. FOT sermons, nothing much was given about the meaning of the feast at all. People were just preaching whatever they felt like. In 1978, that all changed. The co-worker letter from October 23rd, 78, Mr. Armstrong said, the sermons were more deeply spiritual, bringing meat in due season, bringing inspired messages of the now imminent kingdom of God and its rule over all nations for the next 1,000 years. And I just set my watch and then I'll know when to stop. Now, the Pastor General's report of 1980, the question was, must we dwell in booths? He said, just going through the motions of meeting together on each of the feasts would not accomplish God's purpose in giving us these feasts. If we do not proclaim sermons to the people on the meaning of these festivals, that's the key. Why are we there? By 2 or 3 years ago, many ministers had drifted into preaching on these feasts, just whatever subject they themselves like to speak on, and not a word about the meaning of the feast God wants the congregation to bear in mind. This year, every single message was covering some aspect of God's feast. In fact, both before and after the feast, significant sermons were also given, tying in with the overall theme, which we'll see just now. We were, in fact, reminded about the whole plan of God. That is the key. And strangely enough, it's what Mr. Bowles pretty much covered in this week's pastor's report. Surprise, surprise. And we were reminded about the whole plan of God, and it started before the feast. Now, pre-feast, this Mr. Stephen Brough's sermon, are we aware of where we are now? Which, you know, right before the feast, that's a jolly good idea, a good question to ask. He said, just as it is easy to be asleep on the mountainous events currently taking place in the world, so it is also easy to become so absorbed that we miss where our focus should really be centered on what God deems important at this time. You know, if you think about it, God had this plan, and he tied that plan in with holy days. So shouldn't we then, on those holy days, look at that plan? You know, that seems pretty basic, but not to a lot of people, unfortunately. Continue with the sermon. Back in the 1970s, when Mr. Armstrong was working to get the church back on track, President Reagan and Mrs. Thatcher were doing much the same for their nations. You remember at that time, it wasn't just chaos in the church. It's chaos in the world as well, especially in the Israelitish nations. Today, the world is chaotic and confused. Some can't work out what sex they want to be. Nobody's interested in a woman who has an abortion. But if she doesn't get the jab, she can lose her job or her career. She can't ride a train, fly in an airplane. You become a complete non-person just because you don't get the jab. But nothing to worry about an abortion. I mean, that's just, you know, fair game. Some in God's church are also confused. Some now reckon the Sabbath is by the lunar calendar. That's a lot of fun, because the Sabbath then pitches up at all sorts of days during the week. Now, can you imagine trying to hold a job down when the Sabbath's on a Tuesday this week and on a Wednesday next week and then the Friday on the following week and so on? Some deny that Christ was the God of the Old Testament. Some think the two goats on atonement were both representing Christ. You see how it all gets mixed up? We are not to get involved with this world. We are to focus on the return of Christ and the establishment of the kingdom of God. That's what the feast points us to. And then again, just before the feast, we had Mr. Armstrong qualifying or disqualifying yourself. You know, again, looking at the situation, that's a good question to ask. Even before the feast, God started focusing our minds and his meaning in his great plan. That's the key. Mr. Armstrong says, "Well, greetings all you future kings and priests that are going to have these wonderful spiritual crowns. You're going to rule the world. You're going to teach the world the way of peace, to happiness, to joy, and to real accomplishment." Do we see any of that today? We see total chaos. We have a meeting starting tomorrow night in Glasgow, a city, a very, very nice city. But at the moment, unfortunately, the bin men are on strike, so the place is covered in refuse and rats and other things nice. There are 30,000 people gathering there from all over the world to discuss climate change. But some people are not going to be there. They're staying at home because they're not happy. The Queen, of course, has not been well. The Pope changed his mind, sent a video instead. Mr. Putin and gentlemen in China, who caused the vast majority of the pollution on the planet, they're not going to go because they know they're going to get hammered anyway, along with the Japanese Prime Minister and the Indian Prime Minister. So all the key players that are causing 70, 70, 80% of the problem won't be there. Is that chaos? And they're going to be there for 13 days. They're going to be there for 13 days. What's the carbon footprint of that? Yeah, we live in a strange world. These festivals have great meaning. They show God's plan and our part in it, the fact that God is reproducing himself. The world cannot understand his plan, but we can. And you know, that puts us, a few thousand people around the world, in a very special position. We understand things that the great men of this world couldn't get their head around. Like Mr. Hawking, the great physicist and all the rest of it, he was asked about creation. And he said, you know, the further I go back, I'm quite convinced now that the whole creation started from nothing. Profound. And for that, you've got to have three PhDs and a few other LLDs and BDVs and DDTs and all the rest of it after your name to come up with something so profound that people actually listen to you. Because after all, you're educated. Oh. Yes, right, let's get down to the feast. The first night, the opening message. It's another feast of somewhat uncertain times. Now, there's an understatement. A brief history of God's church in uncertain times and the parallels of today. That's what we're looking at. Since the church started keeping the feast was stable. I've never known an unstable feast up until the last 2 years. You always got the same thing every year. God put his name somewhere and we all trooped off to wherever it was and kept the feast and then came home. 2 years ago, that all changed. The virus appeared. Now it's all different. The world is a vastly different place today. It's so difficult to plan anything today due to the confused state of the world with lockdowns, etc. But it's a sign of the times. I might add, I saw this morning in the news that the First Minister in Wales now is having to re-look at everything because of the fact that the numbers are going up and so forth, and the NHS is getting swamped. Very difficult. But as I say, we live in an uncertain world, and although it's a tendency for us to make comparisons with the fellowship that we had, and certainly it was a wonderful time, but we took the feast for granted almost. And if you think so, you know, the things we do all the time, I think this is my 57th feast or something this year. It's a lifetime. Very easy to take things like that for granted. Oh, here we are, feast again, you know. But it's not always been that way. In fact, it's been anything but in the history of God's church, as far as the feast is concerned and as far as even the Sabbath is concerned. Over the centuries, it's been a very dicey business belonging or trying to preach God's truth. Trying to preach the Passover would have been worse than not having the jab. They don't burn you at the stake quite yet for not having the jab. Constantine's Council of Laodicea in 363, he was certainly an enemy of the church and made the following decree to those that wanted to keep the Passover as handed down from the apostles. And they have lovely language. For as much then as is no longer possible to bear with your pernicious errors, we give warning by this present statute that none of you shall henceforth presume to assemble yourselves together. Boom. And if you did, you were hauled off, your property was seized, and you were probably never heard of again. They certainly lived in an uncertain, unpredictable world, and they had to exhibit the faith that was necessary. And if you think we're talking about the far, dim and distant past, the last execution in St. Albans, from memory, was 1555. So it's barely 500 years ago that somebody was actually burnt at the stake in the centre of St. Albans. So in these uncertain and unpredictable times, it didn't matter whether you were a Catholic or a Protestant. If you weren't the right Catholic or the right Protestant, you were facing the death penalty in many cases. We haven't seen anything like that yet. The world is going to become more uncertain as time goes on. Satan knows he has a short time. We need to focus on the meaning of the feast this year. I have a full trust in our faithful Creator. That is a setting for the feast, and a good one, because we are living in uncertain times. We don't know what's going to happen next week. I can give you a whole list of things that could happen with proof. And one of them is the financial collapse. That literally could happen at any time. They are printing money today like it's going out of style, and you can't keep pumping money into an economy without it crashing. It's just history. It happens. On the first holy day, we started off with a pure language. Today, there's a great confusion within languages, even the same language. I mean, North and South Wales, I believe, are, that causes World War III. Using the words, usages and words are corrupted, causing miscommunication. In the millennium, the whole world will be under Christ and one pure language. That is a great starting point. Just think about it, what it would be like. I know when Britain was going into the EU back in the late 60s and so on, we used to fly across to Brussels 2-3 times a week and go into the headquarters there, and it was a nightmare. Because somebody would be giving a briefing in French. So you had to get somebody who could speak French to translate it into English for you. So already you've got one problem. We had one instance where somebody was translating from like French into German and into English. And that really, really gets complicated. And then you go home and you put the news on at 10 o'clock. And I turn to my wife and say, that's not what happened. I was actually in the room. But the story that came out was completely twisted, not deliberately, but because of miscommunication. And then we went into the main messages for the day. And of course, the key thing was restoring of all things. And I mean, isn't this the big thing with the feast? I mean, that's what we look at from every angle, basically. We are vulnerable to all the devices that man has made. After the world is destroyed, what then? The restorers, us, will begin the process of restoring all things. That does not mean iPhones, Facebook, computers. Christ will not intervene until the very last moment. The whole world is going to be totally destroyed. That's what we actually are going to inherit. And Jeremiah 4:23 was quoted. I looked at the earth and it was empty and formless. The word there, empty and formless, is the same words used in Genesis 1. Tohu and bohu. Wrecked. A hulk. He says, I looked at the heavens and there was no light. You see, God's idea of restoring all things is literally take the whole earth back to what it was like. No light. Everything in chaos and confusion and dead. The world will look very similar to what it did in Genesis 1 after Satan's rebellion. Going on in Jeremiah 4, I'd read a little bit in Jeremiah 4. He said, I looked at the mountains and the hills and they trembled and shook. I looked at all the people are gone. The birds in the sky had flown away. I looked and the fertile fields have become a wilderness. The towns lay in ruin, crushed by the eternal's fierce anger. This is what the Lord says. The whole land shall be ruined, but I won't destroy it completely. There'll be some that survive to come back into the land and start a whole new way of life. We are to focus on the future, rebuilding and resettling people. The people will be in a terrible state, having endured the tribulation. They will be physically, mentally, and emotionally scarred. I've been into some places where there's been famine, there's been war, and you just see people sitting there, and there's an emptiness in the face. There's no expression, it's just a face. Even children, they're just staring into the distance, completely gone. And as Mr. Pippi gave him this sermon, he said, we have a huge job coming up and we need to be preparing now because there may not be time tomorrow. Which is something to be thinking about for all of us, because when you're watching the news and you see some of the stuff that's going on, you just wonder if it can ever get any worse. Isaiah 30 verse 20, of course, got an airing several times in the feast. Teachers not being removed in a corner anymore, but your eyes will see them. That tells you a whole lot. It tells you there's going to be teachers, that's us, yes. But it says your eyes will see them. We're not going to be spooks. It won't just be a voice behind you saying, you turn around, there's nobody there. There will be body in front of them, real. This is why it is important for us to be ready. What can be greater than our calling and our destination? What we've been called to is staggering. We then in the afternoon had a sermonette on foundational teaching tools. You know, it's interesting, but it's back to foundation. Foundations came up a whole lot during the feast. But if you're building on the wrong foundation, you're wasting your time. We are learning the fundamental teaching tools that we will need to teach in the future. As this world is falling apart around us, we need to look for solid foundations. I mean, for instance, keeping the Sabbath and the holy days with understanding is building on a solid foundation. Because that's where you can work out why you're here. Then later on we had a sermon of focusing on the future. Focusing on the future is what we're doing on this day. What will be the purpose of those who live in the millennium? We need to focus our minds on the fact there will be a whole new world coming. Everything will be completely new. Everything will be totally different. Our lives have to be a destination or a purpose. That's vital. That's the key. We're going somewhere. And we're going to be doing something. Yet again, God provides a vital teaching aid. The seven laws of success. This is the vital part of what we will be teaching in the beginning of the millennium. You've got these people. They've come out of this tribulation. And you've got to do something with them. You've got to motivate them. You've got to change the mind. You've got to change the mindset totally. Look at what the mindset today is. I'm not going to work. Another $1,000 coming in at the end of the week. Why must I worry? Helicopter money, they call it. Yeah, it's good. Wonderful. Then suddenly you find that there's a whole lot of people not working and things start grinding to a halt. I mean, the first law, you know, fix the right goal. Educational, preparation, good health, drive, resourcefulness. Oh, are they going to have to be resourceful for the first 7 years? They're going to have to live off the land, literally. They're going to have perseverance. They're going to have to stick to it. Now, we can help them by making sure they keep their minds fixed on that goal. And, of course, the all-important seventh law of success is having contact with and the guidance and continual help of God. That's us. We will be there the whole time, helping them, guiding them, leading them, showing how to do things, where to go, how to hold it together, how to sort their brains out. And then you come to the purpose. You know, the purpose of the millennium is actually hidden in plain sight, if you know what to look for. And you can turn to that one, Luke 23. I'll just paraphrase part of this. Christ is then hanging there, and a thief on either side. And the one thief is getting a little bit upset, to say the least. And the other one corrects him. And he said, basically, you know, he's done nothing wrong. You know, why is he dying? And he said to him, Lord, verse 42 of Luke 23, he turned to Jesus and said, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus said unto him, truly I say unto you, today you shall be with me in paradise. That tells you this man is going to be resurrected in the great resurrection. And when he's resurrected, he's going to come into a world that is like the Garden of Eden. That's what it says. And that's Christ saying it. So then, that's what the 1,000 years is all about. We've got to get the whole world into a state where it can support billions of people. Who knows how many? Some people have said 70 billion. It doesn't matter. We'll find out the numbers. But they're pretty terrifying at first glance. And yet, you know, we've got 7 billion people on the planet. I remember a couple of 3 years ago when there was only 5.5-6 billion, they said you could take the whole human race and put it on the Isle of Wight, which is a little, for those of you who don't know, it's a little basically island off the south coast of England. It's not very big. If you stood people shoulder to shoulder, you could put 6 billion people on that piece of land and the rest of the world would be empty. 7 billion people's not that many because they're all concentrated 32 in this city, 27 billion in this city, and so on. Particularly those of you in America, you can drive across the country and you can drive for days and not even see another car. That's the goal. The main job of the millennium is to get the whole earth ready for that resurrection. At the beginning of the millennium, there's one event that is the ultimate game changer. And you read about that in Joel 2:27. You know, without God pouring out his Holy Spirit on all flesh, we are wasting our time because we would be dealing with people who would be hostile and they won't change. You see that in the world today. You can tell them the truth today, just not going to happen. Not going to happen. Flies right over the head. And right now, the world is under a curse. We talk about the final restoration, the restoring of all things is the key. In the New Living Translation, and it's Romans 8:19 comes out as, for all creation is waiting eagerly for the future day when God will reveal who his children really are. And he'll do it when we arrive on the scene as gods. How do you think people are going to react to this? Put your head back some afternoon and just let your mind dwindle on this one. What's it going to be like for them when somebody can appear right in front of them and say, I'll help you with this. I can show you how to get rid of this problem. The big thing we've got to keep in mind is we're not going to try and repair this world. It's a total, unmitigated disaster. This world is Satan's world, and it must be totally destroyed. and everything linked to it must be destroyed. There is nothing we can take through. Absolutely nothing. You know, end time events show that this is the goal that God's got. If you read, and just make a note of Isaiah 24, it says, the earth has broken up and has utterly collapsed. This is all the New Living Translation. It's shaken violently. It staggers around like a drunk. It trembles like a tent in a storm. It falls and will not rise again, for the guilt of its rebellion is very heavy. And how bad is that rebellion? Well, Jeremiah 5 is very similar to the situation with Abraham when he faced up Christ over the Sodom, about finding righteous people there. He says, run up and down every street in Jerusalem, says the Eternal. Look high and low. Search throughout the city. If you can find even one just and honest person, I will not destroy the city. We all know what happened to the city. There wasn't anybody honest and just. And then, of course, just to make sure that everything is finally trashed, you get Revelation 16, verse 18, where you get thunders and lightnings and a great earthquake, such as never was since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake. The cities of the nations fell, the islands all fled, and the mountains were not found. At that time, it would appear, from what this says, that all your big mountain ranges are going to be flattened. I mean, you can see where India, for instance, has been rammed into Asia, forming that big arc of the Himalayas and so on. And all around the world you get this, the Rockies. You can see where land's been squeezed together and forcing up these huge mountain ranges. Well, they're all going to be flattened. Almost like the continents are going to be stretched again, probably making an awful lot more land. And the result? Well, Isaiah 24, verse 1, he says, look, the Eternal is about to destroy the earth and make it a vast wasteland. He devastates the surface of the earth and scatters the people. In verse 19, the earth is utterly broken down. The earth is clean dissolved. It is moved exceedingly. And then eventually, of course, we get the people returning to Israel. And they've got their work cut out. I mean, in the first 7 months, they get their noses rubbed in it to have to clean all the carcasses up, all the skeletons up from the battle that had taken place. That'll rub it in. And this is never going to happen again. You know, as far as they're concerned, is peace. Now we have got, as Mr. Chamberlain said, peace in our time. That's when we'll have peace. And then it talks about in Isaiah 2, you know, people from many nations will come. Let us go up to the mountain of the Eternal. He'll teach us his ways. The Lord goes out from Zion. That's where it all happens. The Lord will meditate between nations and settle international disputes. They will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. There'll be no shortage of scrap metal in the beginning of the millennium, that's for sure. To find out what things will be restored to, we have to look back to what the world was like before the flood, or even before man was thrown out of Eden. The earth really needs to be restored back to the time before Satan's rebellion. And that's where the wheels came off. Up until that time, God's government was everywhere. And of course, Lucifer then rebelled and created the mess that we now see. So that's where the restoration point starts, with the restoring of God's government. Because God's government is what gives the peace. God's government is what gives the prosperity. The earth is so shaken around, it could well be that we go back to a 360-day year. You can work that out from Genesis by looking at the different dates and times there. And of course, there was the curse. You know, God said to Adam in Genesis 3:17, since you listened to your wife and ate from the tree whose fruit I commanded you not to eat, the ground is cursed because of you, and your life you'll struggle to scratch a living. Ever planted seeds? Take beetroot seed. Now, they germinate real quick. Within a week, you've got a little row of little red things. You've also got a nice little row each side of green weeds, three times the size of the beetroot. They seem to come from nowhere. We had an exercise recently getting some brambles that have grown up through a 12-foot hedge that we've got. And they were 15 and 18 foot long. And they grow up, they come out the top, they drop back down to the ground, and where they hit the ground, they root and send out another half a dozen shoots. Talk about day of the triffids. We won't have that. We won't need that. He said, by the sweat of your brow, verse 19, you will have food to eat until you return to the ground from where you were made. For you were made from dust, and to dust you will return. You can eat, but you're going to have to really struggle to get food. Now, you go to Isaiah 55, we see a complete change. Verse 13. Where once there were thorns, cypress trees will grow. Where nettles grew, myrtle will sprout up. These events will bring great honor to the Eternal's name. They will be an everlasting sign of his power and his love. It seems, as you go through these scriptures, that God is the one who does a lot of the planting. And I wonder if that's something we might be involved in. Verse 17 says, when the poor and needy search for water and there is none, and their tongues are parched for thirst, I, the Lord, will answer them. I, the God of Israel, will never abandon them. I will open up rivers for them in the high plateau. I will give them fountains of water in the valleys. I will fill the desert with pools of water. Rivers by springs will flow across the parched ground. I will plant trees in the barren desert. Cedar, acacia, myrtle, olive, cypress, fir, pine. And I am doing this so that they will all see this miracle and understand that it means that the Eternal has done this. The Holy One of Israel has created it. This is what your God's doing for you, people. What an example. But you notice something? It's all give. It's all give. God is giving. He's giving fresh water, which is something we don't really get much of today on the planet. He's giving all sorts of food. He's giving all sorts of trees. The basic landscaping is done by God. Turn to Amos, verse 9, verse 13. The time will come, says the Eternal, when the grain and grapes will grow faster than they can be harvested. Think of it. Today we've got some nice things, lovely grapes. But you've got to make sure you wash them, though, to get all the muck off them, for the insecticides and the fungicides and all the other sides they put on them to try and get them to the stage where they can actually ripen and you can eat them. And verse 6, of course, the animals will be changed. The nature of the animals will be changed to what it was in the Garden of Eden, when the animals all came to Adam, and Adam named them. We all know, of course, the wolf and the lamb and so on. Cow shall graze with the bear. Baby can play with snakes. And some of our kids play with just about that bad, eating worms. The key thing is Isaiah 11 verse 9. Nothing will hurt or destroy in my holy mountain. For as the waters fill the sea, so the earth will be filled with people who know the Eternal. Nothing will hurt or destroy. I mean, you look at the world today. I just keep thinking of that river Ganges there. They're having the problem with the bodies floating down And here you've got people in the shallow water bathing, drinking the water as a religious rite, swimming, ladies washing the clothes, and dead bodies floating down the river just 15 feet away from them. It's interesting, too, you know, in Genesis 2:15, God says that people need to be taught to dress and keep it, the garden, the land. Dress and keep it. To dress means to work with it, right? But to keep it means to guard and protect it. You know, when people are given the land, the most important part of that land they've got is the soil. The soil is what things grow in. If the soil's right, the plants will be right. If the plants are right, the people that eat the plants will be right. And what have we got today? You know, since the 1900s, the value, the nutritional value of a food that we grow has collapsed in many cases. You look at the generation, Sheila's mum and Danuta and so on, just died recently. You know, they were brought up in the beginning of the 20th century. Her parents, they owned a bakery. You know, they baked the bread in the middle of the night. They were buying bread at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And the old horse and cart was going out and delivering it and so on. And the next day, that bread, you could make toast out of it, and that was it. The following day, it's gone. Moldy. No preservatives in it. And the wheat, of course, had what it should have had. And salt was, you had a bunch of healthy people. You know, one of the healthiest times for this country was right after the Second World War. There was no obesity. People were fit. Why? Could have been living on fish and chips. Fish. Fish will be a major part of the diet in the millennium. You've got water everywhere and it talks about fish in it. And fish, you just go catch them. You don't need to store them. You just go out and catch them, cook them and eat them. If you've ever done that, I've caught trout and cooked it within a couple of hours. And there's nothing like it. It's just nothing like it. Even buying it in the shop when it's 2-3 days old. Nations are going to work together. We have this highway. This was mentioned several times in the feast. It goes all the way from Egypt, all the way up through Israel, all the way up through what is today Turkey, into Syria, Germany. 2,500 miles. I had Alex plot it on Google Earth. He drew the line up the way through there, and there it is. I'm telling you, 2.5, not kilometers, miles. You know, if you're going to walk from Egypt to Assyria, you might make it for the next feast, maybe. There's going to be some way of driving up that road. There's going to be some purpose for that road. And there is. It talks about trade between Egypt and Assyria and Israel. So there's definitely going to be some kind of technology. It might be vastly different from what we have today. I know I've mentioned this before, but my dad took me to the steelworks one time where he worked, and what a filthy, stinking, horrid place. Never seen anything like it. Everything seemed to be covered with bits of metal and grease, and it's a terrible stench coming off it. And my dad said, he said, if they would just spend 2% of their gross profit, this factory could look like a hospital. It could be absolutely clean. But they won't do it, because the competitors won't do it. And that's what it's all about, isn't it? Making money. In fact, I'll tell you something. Keep this in mind as we now go into the final death throes of this world. Always follow the money. I'll be doing the update next week on this COP26 thing. You follow the money. It's very interesting where you end up. Not where you think you're going to end up, I can promise you. It's all about making money. Yeah, Isaiah 19, verse 23. In that day there'll be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrians shall come to Egypt, and the Egypt to Assyria, and the Egyptians shall serve with the Assyrians. Who are they going to be serving? Well, they're going to be serving Israel. Verse 24. In that day Israel will be the third with Egypt and Assyria, even a blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance. That's a kind of a different world to today. Very different world. The Feast of Tabernacles pictures the millennium under the rule of Christ and the born children of God, a time when all living will be called and saved if they are willing. God's not going to force anybody. But I think when people see the results and they see God beings around them and they're told, this is what you're going to be like, I don't think many would turn that down, do you? And then we had a look at fear. You know, I was just thinking about you'll see on the news that's gone up last night, quite a few articles on the Great Reset. There'll be a few more tomorrow as well, just so we all understand what this is all about. But that's what we're coming to, you know. We're coming to a Great Reset, a total reset. And that's what we're involved in, a completely total thing. In this, there'll be no fear at all. There'll be no fear of famine. There'll be no fear of war. There'll be no fear of pestilence. There'll be no fear of wild beasts. There'll be no fear of perverts walking the street and trying to get hold of your kids. That won't exist. It simply won't exist. And to add to that, there's the spiritual blessing that these people will have. In Leviticus 26, verse 12, will be fulfilled. And it says, I will walk among you and will be your God, and you will be my people. Think about that. And then we had the mountaintop experience. And it's quite interesting pointing out that so many things in the Bible happened up mountains. There's a reason, too, for this. A, it's private. You can see if anybody's going to interfere with you. But if you've ever been up a mountain, we did it in Switzerland when we were over there students, and we got one of these places you get up from the cable car type jobs. You don't walk. It's too much like hard work walking up some of these huge these mountains. But you get to the top, and you can see forever, literally. The Matterhorn was in the distance, and there was a plaque on there showing the names of all the mountains and giving the distances from where we were standing. And I covered that in my hand, and we had about eight or nine students and Mrs. Horn as a chaperone. And I said, right, that's the Matterhorn. How far is it? And we were looking at 5 miles, 10 miles. Somebody got really carried away. Oh, it must be at least 15 miles. It was 60 miles away. 60 miles. And it's so crystal clear. You look like you could almost touch it. We stopped to have a picnic lunch on a slope. And as the slope got higher and higher and higher, and it was quite smooth, it was quite easy to walk on it, there was a snow line. And two or three of the girls said, we'd like to go up to the snow. I said, all right, go. But I said, in 1 hour, I'm going to sound the car horn, and wherever you are, you got to turn around and come back. Otherwise, we're going to mess the rest of the day up. Oh, we'll be up there in 20 minutes. They never even got halfway to. Never even got halfway to. Completely misjudged the distance because it was so clear. We were up in the Eastern Transvaal with them, the older boys, and there's a place called Ribi Gorge, which is a bit like the Grand Canyon. It's nicer in that it's covered with forest, and you're standing there on this ledge, and there's aloes right next to you, and it's hummingbirds, like bees, just buzzing. You can feel the air coming off them. And they're totally ignoring you. I mean, you could reach out and touch them. But the guys got really excited because the fire guy has a plane, this fire spotter, and they fly up and down, making sure there's no fires. And he was down there. And there were clouds down there. And suddenly you were on top of the mountain. We had a similar experience when we took them up to the Lake District and carried the one up on my shoulders, this one, all the way up to the top of the hill. And you stand at the top of the hill and you're looking down on the lake. And again, a light aircraft flew down way below us. And it's a tremendous feeling. You also feel very significant. In a landscape like that, you know, you're this big. That's what the Catholics all try to do with their huge cathedrals. You walk into, like, Westminster Abbey or one of these huge ones, and, you know, you really feel like this. You feel tiny because the building is so vast and it just goes up forever and ever, you know. But God's a great one for taking people up mountains. In that sermon, again, it was back to Isaiah 35, which came up several times, about the desert rejoicing and blossoming as a rose. And, you know, it's a time we've got to focus on, because this is what it's all about. The lame man shall leap as a hart. I'm looking forward to that bit. The tongue of the deaf shall sing. I always tease a good friend of mine down in Plymouth about that. He'll be able to sing in tune then. For in the wilderness we waters break out, and streams in the desert. And the whole earth will be a beautiful place. It will be a beautiful place. There won't be rubbish in the streets with rats running around in it. And a scripture that was quoted several times is 1 Corinthians 2, verse 9. You can note that, because you know it very well. As it is written, eye hath not seen, nor ear heard, neither has it entered into the heart of man, the things which God has prepared for those who love him. Now, as a lot of things entered my mind, you're thinking about what it can be like and just visualizing it and so on. I've got a pretty vivid imagination, but you know, looking at that, you can't get it. What's up front is colossal. I can't think of a word even bigger. He says, but God has revealed them to us by his Spirit, for the Spirit searches all things, yea, even the deep things of God. The deep things of God involve knowing about the kingdom of God, knowing about our position in that kingdom, knowing that you're never going to get a P45. You can't get fired. Yeah, that's pretty good. There are rules in day three. We got into fairness in business. In the millennium, because people were living God's way, there'll be honesty and trust in businesses, unlike today's world, where everything's based on greed, where people hold back stock to make sure the price gets to a reasonable level, and then they slowly release it into the marketplace. Debts, paid on time. One of the things with supermarkets, occasionally you'll see a product disappear. And I queried it with one of them. A certain beer, which I rather liked, disappeared off the shelves. And I found that what actually happened was that they were paying the brewery 120 days. In other words, 120 days after they got an order in, they were paying the brewery. But they were ordering in stuff every 2 weeks. So this huge volume of stock, which they had long since sold, the money was still lying in the bank with the supermarket. And the brewery turned around and said, we can't survive like this. We need paying 30 days finish. And they said, no, we're not paying 30 days. So they said, right, you're not selling our product then. Boom, boom. But that's the get way. And it's not that long ago. I remember as a kid, my mom used to go to the baker and get a dozen rolls. But you weren't given the dozen rolls. You were given 13. Baker's dozen. Given that little bit extra. Do you get that today? Ah, you can't get 13 rolls in a plastic bag, can you? Then we looked at employment in the millennium. You know, it says, if you lost a job because of your belief, wouldn't a world of zero unemployment be great? No welfare, no food stamps, no healthcare, no hospices, police, military, security, lawyers. You think of all the jobs that won't need to exist. As I say, it's going to be totally different. Absolutely and utterly, totally different. And then Isaiah 41 was again quoted. In fact, God's going to do it. And again, the highway linking Egypt's mentioned. These things come up several times. And they come up several times for a reason. That God wants this. This is the thing he's going to get into our heads. You know, real prosperity is not having the latest iPhone or Xbox, Y box, or whatever box you've got. It's really having a good supply of healthy food. And wine, of course. You've got to have wine with food. Well, the Apostle Paul told Timothy to take a little wine often for his stomach's problems. Seriously. Yeah, that's what it's all about. And Amos 9 was quoted, the day is coming when the ploughman shall overtake the reaper and the treader of grapes, him that sow the seeds. And, you know, it says they will build the waste cities, inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards, drink the wine thereof. They shall make also gardens and eat the fruit of them. That's what it's all really about. Very few people today can sit down and say, very few ladies, for instance, are going to say, what am I going to do for dinner tonight? And I think I'll do a nice veggie stir fry. And I'll roast one of those chickens. And then she goes out the back and she grabs the chicken and off he goes, ready for the oven. And then she gets a trugger or whatever. And she goes and picks a leek and a couple of carrots and an onion and a fresh into the house, chops them all up, and ready for stir fry. I remember once going into a 3-star Hugo and Rene restaurant. One of those mad things you do. And ordering a rump steak, and they brought the rump steak to the table, the whole rump, on a trolley, and the guy there with a nice big knife, where do I cut? He cut this huge slice of steak off. And I said, you know, can I have some vegetables with it? He said, oh, what would you like? So he got. He said, let's see, we've got onions, we've got broccoli, we've got this, did a whole lot of stuff. I said, yeah, a mixture of that. That'd be nice, isn't it? And then I said to him, where do you get veggies? Because this is way up in the countryside, there's nothing around for miles. I said, where do you get the veggies from? He said, look out the window. And the back of the restaurant was a traditional walled garden with all the veggies growing. And we watched, and sure enough, somebody went out and pulled up a leek and pulled up a this, and pulled up a few carrots, and that's what we ate. Do you know they tasted different? Well, if you've grown carrots, you take a carrot, wash it under the tap, or if you're a kid, you just shake the dirt off it, and away you go. One of our boys, we grew these little gem lettuce, nice and compact things, and it was our Andrew. I couldn't understand where these were going. These slugs are, you know, they're in my lettuce. It was a slug, all right. He'd come home from school, go out the back, just shake the slugs out of it, not even wash it, shake the slugs, and he'd chomp it. Somebody else I know wiped out my entire parsley tray with his friend. They just enjoyed it. And it was fresh parsley. Must cause you to grow a beard, I guess. They turn to Zechariah, well, make a note of it, Zechariah 8. And the Eternal said, I'm returning unto Zion and will dwell in the midst of Jerusalem. Jerusalem shall be called a city of truth. Oh, how's that for a joke in today's world? Any city of truth, particularly Glasgow. You're going to hear more porkies this next 13 days when these guys are all having a go up there trying to sort the world's problems out. Thus says the Lord of hosts, there shall yet be old men and old women dwelling in the streets of Jerusalem, and every man with his staff on his hand for very age. And the streets of the city shall be full of boys and girls playing in the street thereof. Oh, boys and girls and boys and girls. No in-betweens. And they're playing, free from fear. Because there's nobody around to harm them. There aren't any pedophiles. There aren't people trying to get them to read books at school that are quite... I must tell you about that. This lady, her son came home from school and he said, you know, he was a bit distraught about this book that he'd found in the library. And it was a book about people of a certain sexual orientation with complete photographs of exactly what they do and all the rest of it. And, of course, his mother was incensed, took the book, and went to a PTA meeting where she asked to speak, and she was granted permission. So she got up, and she started reading from this book. Obviously a nice, juicy section of it. And the speaker told her, shut up, we're not having that filth in here. And she said, well, why do you allow this in your library? Oh, we've got to give the children a broad education. That's the kind of world we live in. I'm so glad I haven't got kids in school. Well, they wouldn't be in school. That's all there is to it. Education in the millennium is the next topic. Today's education, of course, is all based on a system that started thousands of years ago with people like Plato. The children are not taught how to think. They're taught how to pass exams. I often smile at Mr. Armstrong referring to one of his grandchildren or whatever it was, getting into trouble at school, been asked about the North American Indians. You know, who discovered America? And he said, well, the Indians did. And he got clobbered for it because, no, he didn't. Columbus did. It's even worse than that. Evidently, the Vikings did. So now, you know, he was even more right than Columbus was a latecomer. But, yes, we had a nice quote from Charles Dickens, which I think describes today's world. It was the best of times, the worst of times. That's brilliant, isn't it? That really is brilliant. The paradox of today's world. We have near instant access to the world's knowledge and also to the world's evils. reputations can be ruined, lies spread, hatred spread, vitriol spread. Vile. And yet, I still, as I say, I'm going to be doing, almost certainly doing the update for next week on this COP26. I shall sit at the computer and I shall type in history, COP26, and up will come an article saying, well, COP1 was this and COP2, this started way back in, well, the last century, 70s or 80s. And this is the 26th meeting of this group. Yeah. And I've got all that there, and I can then check on who said what. I can check on, and I can do all that before my coffee's gone cold, which it normally does. Because it's all there, just at the flick of a switch. And if I can't find anything, I either throw it at my wife or Paula, who then gave me the answers. But you can find things. You can find almost anything you want on the internet. It is a wonderful, wonderful tool. I often wonder what Mr. Armstrong, we were talking about this the other night, I wonder what Mr. Armstrong would have done with today's technology. Yeah. I really do wonder what he'd have done with it. I mean, he was way ahead of his time, and we were having satellite broadcasts around the world when it was in its absolute infancy. Must have cost us a fortune. But he is a great one in using technology. What would he do today? Would he be on Twitter? He'd probably be kicked off Facebook long ago. Oh, dear. He says, this world has been built on a foundation of lies, as Paul wrote, tomorrow's world will be based on truth. Based on truth. Built on truth. The fear of the eternal is the beginning of knowledge. True knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. Today the family is under attack. The line between male and female is blurred. Women rule. Men just are accidents looking for a place to happen. Children are being pictured as being smarter than their parents. Tomorrow's family will be built on solid foundation, where children will obey their parents, wives will be true helpmeets to their husband, and men will be true leaders in the family. And the key point? Well, guess what? Back to Isaiah 30, verse 20 again. Because this will happen, because your eye will see your teachers. And if you get it wrong, there'll be a voice behind you saying, don't let your wife get away with that one, buddy. You're in trouble. Or to a child, it might not be good to keep going down the road you're going on. It might result in a board meeting, if you know what I mean. And then you get the educated of this world. Paul dealt with them, didn't he? Yes. Here's what he had to say about Plato and all the other learned people. Romans 1:20, for the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. And in verse 22, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. Some of you may remember back in July, I think it was. Yes, at the beginning of July, I put a picture up on the forum of a rather beautiful orchid that my wife had bought. Very unusual, and it has six stems, right? It's dying after four solid months of flowering. What a stunning plant. What a beautiful plant. And we can't really explain how these things grow. We don't know. We don't know where the life in it comes from. You can go down to the mini micro stage and beyond, but there's nobody yet come up and said, that's what causes the life. That's what causes the life in each atom in our body. We can't do that. But God knows, because he controls it. Today's world has been built on faulty foundations, and the building is starting to collapse. God's world, based on give, will soon take over, and life will be different, totally different. And again, the same thought is coming up. And these sermons are all coming from people dotted all over the place, Nobody knew what anybody else was talking about. Amazing, isn't it? God's plan is so important that he has us rehearse the whole thing every year. Every year. As I say, this is my 57th feast. Was you 60? 61? Yeah. 61st feast, my wife. She was 12 when she went to the first feast. It's been a way of life with us. But you know what? Every time, every year, there's something else comes up. It's a small point. But restore all things. Came to me this in this feast. I forget who said it. But somebody made the comment. We're not just restoring back to the Garden of Eden. We're restoring back to before the rebellion of Lucifer. Because that is when it went pear-shaped. That's the key to the whole thing. That's the key where we're living in a world today that's so mad. We don't have God's law. It's run by Satan, and we know what what he's like. Again, the whole way of life changes. Mr. Armstrong mentioning that he's been talking to people around the world, and he said, we don't have utopia today because of our lifestyle, the way we live. But he shows how even this situation fits within the incredible purpose of the great creator God. What we are learning now, what you're watching now, it's not just a matter of watching the news, it's watching how people live, watching how people do things, and realizing the end result of it and seeing how totally wrong it is. Because we are the ones that are going to have to, have to sort this out. Get to day 7, and again, the restitution of all things comes back up again. And again, the increase of his government and peace, there should be no end. The total peace is only possible under God's government. There ain't no other way. Man cannot do it. He's proved it over 6,000 years. And then we had the sermon on commerce in the world tomorrow. Totally different. Totally different. You've got to get people into a give. No matter what you're making, what you're selling, it's got to be a give-orientated thing. We've got to look at quality. That's something that's gone today, isn't it? You know, you look at some of the old motor cars that were built in the 1920s, 1930s. All beautiful, solid wood, not chipboard with a tiny bit of veneer on it. Really, really quality. People took time. People took pride in what they did, and they planned. I mean, we've got Joseph there, looking at sorting out Egypt's problems, and leaving Pharaoh pretty well off at the end of it as well, and the great usury. Here's a question for you. Who is getting all the usury, all the interest on the $200 trillion of debt that this world is drowning in right now? Who is getting all that money? Well, the bankers are, because they control the money supply. The value of currency tied to the land. What the land produces is what value is the value. There's no other value. No inflation. No usury within Israel. Anybody outside Israel, we can clobber them. But not a fellow Israelite. Interest is one of the great killers. And I'm afraid it's about to hurt a lot of people with mortgages, because we are, whatever they may tell you in some of the press, true inflation at the moment is between 10 and 15% in the Western world, and increasing. And at some stage, the banks are going to put interest rates up, which means that anybody who's saving will make a little bit of money again. And if you've got a mortgage, your monthly repayments will go literally through the roof. And yeah. Last great day. The all things and forever we had. Psalm 8 verse 6, you made him to have dominion over the works of your hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet. Ultimately, ultimately that will happen. You know, when you can go out in the garden and everything's growing, there's the weeds problems taken care of, we got rid of all the mosquitoes, or stopped them biting, one of the two, the animals are all friendly. That would be nice. That's having things in subjection. Don't try it today with a tiger or a lion. They are not in subjection to you. Believe me. You'll end up inside them. And forever, of course, is Isaiah 9:6. For unto us a child is born, you know, his government goes on for eternity. The increase of his government and peace shall be no end. What's ending is Satan's world. But God's government's forever. In Revelation 21, verse 5, he sat on the throne and said, "Behold, I make all things new." And he said to me, "Write, for these words are true and faithful." And of course, you go back to verse 1 of Revelation 21, and he says, "I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea." Everything is going to change at that stage. A new heaven and a new earth. What that means, I don't know fully. Are we going to see a completely revamped universe? Is the universe that we see now, is it actually still there? Because most of these starlights are usually twinkling at night time. That light has been traveling for millions of light years to get here. The actual thing causing the light might have disappeared long ago. Isaiah 65, verse 17, is one of those scriptures that really makes your life dwindle, makes your mind dwindle. Because if you think about what it's actually saying, Isaiah 65, verse 17, it says, "For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered nor come to mind." The New Living Translation says, "Look, I'm creating new heavens and a new earth, and no one will ever even think about the old one anymore. Be glad, rejoice over my creation." So what's coming? What's coming is so breathtaking that God can't really explain it to our puny little human minds. It's just too vast. But it's certainly wonderful. And it will certainly involve righteousness. And then we looked at the job we will have. Which again leaves you feeling a little bit, how? 1 Corinthians 6:2. "Do you not know the saints shall judge the world? If the world should be judged by you, are you unworthy to judge the smallest matter?" They were getting involved in suing each other and all the rest of it. "Know you not that we shall judge angels?" I'll let your mind dwindle on that one for a while. Yeah, we shall judge angels. And again, 1 Corinthians 2, verse 9, again comes up. "As it is written, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, neither has it entered into the heart of man, the things which God has prepared for them that love him." Just incredible. And then, of course, finally, we have the awakening of all mankind, the great white throne judgment, when everybody who's ever lived resurrected. Sounds fantastic. And yet, you know what? It's here in plain English. Matthew 10. "Verily I say unto you, it shall be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of the judgment for this city." Verse 22, "It'll be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon." Verse 23, "Capernaum, you know, you're exalting yourself now." If the, you know, it goes on, and then down in verse 24, "There should be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for you." So what's that saying? Verse 41, "The men of Nineveh shall rise in judgment with this generation." He's talking to the people there in front of him. He's saying to them, when you're resurrected, Nineveh, those people will be resurrected at the same time. along with the people from Sodom and Gomorrah and Tyre and so on. Throw in the Queen of the South for an encore. They're all coming up together. There is from Christ. Could people see it? No. Why? Because you've got to have God's Spirit to understand how God thinks, how God works, and you've got to understand God's plan. The feast's finished now, but the story continues. After the feast, we had a sermon on persevering to the end, which is something we've got to do. We've got to keep our eyes on the goal. We've got to run with consistent effort. We've got to be totally committed. We've got to understand the purpose of trials. We've got to hold fast to the truth, to overcome fear of failure, and always to trust in the power of God. That's where we've got to be going. And then we had the other split sermon on becoming unglued. And this is a big problem. You know, in the church today it's happened. People get to where they can't understand which way to go, so they just walk away. Gone. In their thousands. It's terrible. And talks about the people who become unglued. They lose the center. They lose God's perspective. And that's what we've got to be gaining. Starting to think a little bit like he does. Yes, some things that are going to be happening are horrible. But they happen, they've gone, and then we get on with sorting it out. And all those who've died in the meantime will get a chance. But they'll get a chance in a world that works. And Mr. Armstrong then finished things off the following week by saying the unthinkable will happen. And he says, well, brethren, I guess it's still the same old thing. There is good news and bad news. There are some wonderful good news clear beyond the human comprehension coming, but there is also some bad news. He says, still completely beyond comprehension. That's coming first. And, of course, we have the tribulation coming. Hopefully, those who are doing their best to follow God will be taken to the place of safety that he's promised. I certainly wouldn't want to go through the tribulation. You look in history and look at some of the terrible things that have happened, and all that pales into insignificance. You can see the hatred even building now over the jab business. Yeah, they want to destroy people. Terrible. Well, that gives an idea. You can see where God's coming from. He wants us to get into our heads. His plan is the most important thing in our lives, right? And the knowledge we have is utterly priceless. Utterly priceless. Nobody else has this. They can't understand it. You might as well try explaining it to next door's dog. They can't get it. They cannot understand because they don't have that vital thing called the Holy Spirit to open up their minds. I'd just like to end by putting things in context, which I think works. The world is going to become more uncertain as time goes on. Satan knows he has a short time. We need to focus on the meaning of the feast this year and have full trust in our faithful Creator. While we are now living in uncertain and unpredictable times, we need to focus on the future. God doesn't look back. You can't change a single thing that you did yesterday or the day before or the month before. But you can change this tomorrow. We have a huge job coming. As Mr. Pippi actually said, we have a huge job coming. We need to be preparing now because there might not be time tomorrow.